Hi, I'm Sharad Kutan, and welcome to Let's Talk, the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. Today in Parliament, the Prime Minister tabled the midterm review of the 11th Malaysia Plan, and during his speech, he gave a rousing address, an assertion. He said that if the plan was followed to the T, that Malaysia could return as an Asian tiger. That's an extraordinary assertion in the 21st century. The question is, to what extent do national governments have control over their economies and those dynamics? Now, we're going to be going to Lawrence Todd from the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs to get an answer to that conceptual question. Really, do national governments have control of that sort these days? Part of the plan includes the development of human capital. When we think of human capital, we think of talent or creativity. And there's many buzzwords around that, including the creative industries. And that's going to be the topic for today's discussion. Joining me in the studio today is Ann Sathrina. She is with the Cultural Economy Development Agency, as Chandana it's called, and also Amir Mohammed, because a doyen of the independent film movement. He's a publisher of independent books, if you like to call them that, with Fixie Books. And because now he's returned to film as a producer, and he's got a new company called Kuman Films. And we're going to be talking to him about the film industry as part of the creative industry sort of sector. Thank you guys for joining me so much. Are you looking wonderful?
I am your ambassador after
yeah,
all.
Yeah, you come in Let's Talk Colours. And I really love that. And Ame,
yes.
You're in batik, but you know, I love batik, so what can I say? Okay, there's a lot of buzzwords that are used, and politicians have been very quick to pick up on these buzzwords. You know, Industry 4.0, the creative industries. Do they mean anything anymore? You know, Izan, you of course have committed through your organisation to promote the cultural dimension of the creative industries. Tell us, what does it really mean?
Well, as you know, I started Chandana 2 years back, and we're all about building a vibrant, sustainable and ambitious cultural economy for Malaysia. And based on what the Honourable Prime Minister mentioned today, there's a lot of angles for us to play a role as well, especially in professional development and capacity. And I think cultural economy still has a lot of role and space for us to do a lot of things for the nation, especially.
Right, so it still has a salience.
Yes,
and I can see why you would say that, because there are politicians, and Amir, I think you remember this, I believe the MP Tony Pua came out to say that, you know, there's a crisis and we have to cut back, and one of the things we're going to have to, you know, cut back on is culture, right, and the support for culture and the arts. Do you think he misunderstands culture, especially when you look at some of the numbers coming out of the film industry where you're from?
Yeah, because I think that's a very old-fashioned, utilitarian view that culture is something done as a hobby or as a kind of a dilettante kind of thing or a prettifying thing. But I think nowadays it is quite obvious that culture is what they call soft power, I think. So if you look at... In East Asia, I mean, the rise of Korea, for example, it's a lot based on their cultural exports.
Oh, the cave wave, the
cave wave.
But, you know, yeah, and that was interesting. You talk about hobbyists and, you know, this idea that, in fact, I think Tony Pua, you know, went on to say that when he retires, he'd like to become an artist, you know,
yeah, kind of like... When I retire, I'd want to be a politician as well.
Aha!
So I can say any nonsense and it'll be a news item.
Okay. If you remember Amir's series of books called Politicians Say the Darndest Things. Now, Izan, how do we get granular when we talk about the culture industry? What is it that we're actually looking at?
Well, if we look at the big picture, the different subsector in the cultural economy, we have performing arts, we have visual arts, we have literature and publishing, we have crafts, museums, and music. And I was sharing with Amir earlier on, actually literature and publishing, based on the last numbers in 2016, contributed like half a billion to the KL GDP.
The Kuala Lumpur GDP?
Kuala Lumpur GDP. Literature was really contributing a lot. After that was museum. After that, I think it's performing arts, visual arts, music, then crafts.
Well, this is extraordinary, because I think one of the things that Izan wants to do with Chandana is to actually bring the numbers to bear on policy, right?
Yes.
It's a data-driven initiative,
evidence-based approach. I think at the end of the day, when we look at the creative economy, the subsectors are divided across 4 different ministries and up to 24 government agencies. So the idea of cultivating a creative economy is best when we're together. And so we can work towards a common objective and therefore create a collective impact. I think with what's happening right now, and especially when we're talking about moving the economy, and I think the speech today was a lot about heart, and it was a lot about people. But when we move also with, a lot of it mentioned technology, the people that's most critical in the future are people with creativity. So I think it's best for us to always bear in mind the role of culture and creativity in the space.
You know, so creative is an interesting thing because sometimes it gets lumped together with artistic creativity, but creativity is just an adjective that can be applied everywhere, right? You can be creative in your policy making, you can be creative in engineering and innovation.
Accountants are creative all the time.
Yes, that we don't encourage. Yeah. That we don't want to encourage. Yeah. But how do you see it from a filmmaker's perspective, from a book publisher's perspective? Mm-hmm. Do you think that we have that in the making in Malaysia, that stuff that could be deepened, you know? In fact, the government has this idea of being a critical enabler for the cultural, for the economy, and what are the elements to that will enable it? What's your perspective on that?
I think enabling is a good word, is an interesting word, because they should not interfere in things where they will be detrimental. For example, our censorship system is still stuck in a very regressive kind of phase, although there have been some improvements, maybe in terms of newspapers, you can see that. But film censorship is still stuck in that same phase. But also, not to interfere with that, but to interfere or to have policies to do with education and training, where you do need, you know, that kind of state support. It can't be left entirely to the private sector, because private sector, the world over, is about making the quick buck that then itself. It's not about investing in institutions that will last.
Yeah, talking about censorship, this is very interesting, because it just at recently concluded Kuala Lumpur Festival, they were going to show your film, your old film, right? And which apparently is still banned. Yeah, so yeah. The new Malaysia hasn't caught up to some of the old practices. Do you think that the censorship thing is as big as many of us, and kind of the, you know, the Bangsa crowd, the, you know, the super liberals?
Oh, no.
You know, we love talking about censorship because we are particularly concerned about the encroachment of the large state on our lives. Is it a big inhibitor?
Censorship, I think, is going to take some time to advocate. And one thing, I was in a seminar this morning. It was attended, someone from MACC spoke, and he talked about fight about corruption. And I feel like when we're in our space of culture and creativity, we no longer essentially advocate. Sometimes we have to fight for culture, we have to fight for creativity. And it's really important for us to just continue and look into it. And
So is it as big as we think it is? As a barrier to the development of the scene?
I think it will be somewhat, but I think slowly we can advocate for it. And really, I mean, for us, I think our priorities at the moment is looking into partnerships, looking into making linkages between education institutions, helping on professional development. I think that's priority for us. And definitely getting more private sector involved in the arts, because I think, like what Amir said, at the end of the day, we can't necessarily always rely on the government to do everything. We also need the private sector, but we also need the government to enable on policies. At the end of the day, they're the one who can tweak. I mean, the policies are already there. It's just sometimes about, I think we talked about this before, policies for commercial work and policies for non-commercial work. There needs to be a distinction, and therefore, government still plays a very important role.
Okay. Now, you know, before we kind of wrap this up, the question of, you know, the market versus the state, and Amir, you kind of plotted out the profit-driven motives of the market, right? But there are also private endowments, people who come, you know, with a view of the long term who are not part of the state necessarily, come with very different agendas. They're not nationalistic agendas. They're not trying to win the vote. Is there anything of that sort happening in Malaysia or a space for it?
I think there is some, but it tends to be quite sporadic and often based on sometimes even the personal interests of whoever
of the
runs,
patron.
Yeah, whoever runs these foundations and things like that. So it can't be relied on to be, you know, a kind of a Ford Foundation or whatever, where it goes on for decades. I don't think we have that equivalent here necessarily.
No. And what about the ecosystem? Is it at the end of the day partly market driven, partly state sponsored, partly these whims and fancies of patrons, some of them who might be visionary?
It's a mix of everything at the moment, pretty much. I think you have patrons very much. We have to move with what they're most passionate about. And you're very, I think some of the foundations we work with, we're very fortunate because they really have the heart for the arts. Therefore, it's easier to deliver what we envision for the whole community. But at the same time, it takes a lot of educating and advocating at different levels, be it private sector, be it the government, and also the community. But everyone plays an important role in it.
Okay. I'm speaking to Izzan Satrina, also Amin Mohammed. We'll be back with a deeper look at filmmaking in this country. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me in the studio, Izzan Satrina with the Cultural Economy Development Agency of Cendana and Amin Mohammed of Kuman Films. We're going to get more into what he means and why he called it Kuman Films in just a while. But interesting to note that today in Parliament, the Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir, actually mentioned cinemas. And this is what he had to say.
Negara perlu memanfaatkan revolusi perindustrian keempat. Oleh itu, rangka kerja dasar nasional mengenai 4IR akan dibentuk untuk menggalakkan inovasi, kreativiti dan daya saing dalam menghadapi revolusi digital yang semakin berkembang pesat. Manakala dasar negara mengenai industri 4.0 2018-2025 yang menggariskan plan tindakan penggunaan teknologi berkaitan industri 4.0 akan dilancarkan untuk meningkatkan produktiviti dan daya saing serta pembuatan.
Okay, that was the Prime Minister, Dr. Mahathir, talking about Industry 4.0. He didn't actually mention cinemas in that clip, but we'll try and get that for you later. Now we'll come back to our discussion, which is, and you can see the word creative industries is there in the mix, right? It's aligned with the idea of digitization and so on. Do you think there is essentially a continuity between the previous administration when Cendana was actually kind of born and this administration, new government, in kind of recognizing the importance of the creative industries?
I think we can't deny that, again, whilst the... I think Jack Ma said it quite well. You know, at the end of the day, the future will always be with technology, but the ones that they're going to hire the most will be people with critical thinking and creative ways of doing things. They want people with imagination. So creativity is still important for us in the long run, for our children and for the future generations. So I still am a strong believer. And I still think perhaps our country will definitely want to embrace that. We're rich in culture. We're very passionate people.
But are we critical? And this is, you know, it's interesting. I mean, you're actually a lawyer by training. I know this, but you also were kind of, you know, child savant. He started writing for the NSD at an early age when he was a teenager. You know, the criticality, is it there? Because to be imaginative, to be creative, to create something new, which is implied in the term, something new, not a repetition of the old, requires a bit of courage as well to break with, you know, what came before. What's your sense of where we are on that score, at least when it comes to filmmaking?
I think the referring to the earlier conversation about censorship, I think the biggest achievement that censorship has done is that they don't have to do so much because the sensors are already in our head. So it's that line about the devil, the greatest trick the devil thing is that. So in that sense, that is what inhibits it. It's not like once these institutions go away, you will automatically have such a vibrant, critical kind of culture, because it's already been inbred in our education system.
Do you agree? I mean, I see a lot of rebellion out there. I think there are a lot of kids who are modeling themselves, not on what the school teachers say to them they ought to do, not what politicians do, but actually on a global culture which they can access instantaneously on their laptops or their phones.
But not everyone is a super liberal, and not everyone has access to internet to be able to, I suppose, move with critical thinking, be able to respond to issues. I mean, I come from a private school, Bukit Bintang Girls' School, and we were taught to always critique. We were always reading a lot of English. We had to wash bathrooms. And I feel perhaps the public education system is a bit slightly different. That
isn't BBJS public school?
It is.
Oh.
And therefore, I feel that, I mean, we have confidence. We were also provided opportunities to ask questions. We're not being scolded. We wouldn't be punished for raising any concerns. But perhaps not everyone has that environment to be able to explore different things.
Okay, that may be true. But I remember the heyday of the independent cinema, movement when video was used because it was cheap and it was easy. You had an amazing flourishing of stories, stories that were not approved by, certainly you might not want to have your parents watch it, for instance. I mean, where was that coming from, that impulse to do something different?
There were not many films like that. And it has to be said that after a while, it kind of snuffed itself out.
Or did it?
And people wanted to make films for Astro.
I think
in Southeast Asia now, when it comes to independent filmmaking, and I define independent as just people who make films with no thought about how they want to release them yet, or not made for a specific client or made for a specific sponsor platform, we're still lagging behind compared to other Southeast Asian countries.
Oh,
yeah. Well, okay, so let me just look at some of the numbers that we have from, blockbuster Malaysian films. Munafik 2, taking in about 37 million. Hantu Kat Lima, 36. You go down, Ola Bola, about 16. And KL Gangster, around 11 million ringgit. Is that a handsome number, Amir?
Yeah. This year has been extraordinary in terms of box office for Malaysian cinema. It's a record-breaking thing. I mean, the total for the year will end up being like 150 million in terms of gross receipts. That's like double, or almost double the previous record.
And who do we give credit for that? Is it just the independent filmmakers or the production?
Pakatan Harapan, of course. They are the enablers.
Rise Up. Was that film called Rise Up?
Or the converse, because people got sick of watching news on TV, so they decided, let's all go and watch Ghosts on the big screen, maybe.
They naturally always loved ghost films, I think.
Okay, so you have also this real interesting dynamic between what is commercially successful and what's critically successful. And the critically successful things, films or books or whatever, might not be taking in a lot of money, but they make a name. They make a name for the country, they make a name for the economy. It might actually draw people here saying, what's happening in Malaysia that you're producing these interesting stories? Needless to say, a billion-dollar whale is something that we can thank the previous administration for giving us. But where, in say, the story of filmmaking is on, should government come in?
Should government come in filmmaking?
At all?
I think to a certain extent, yes. Look at the success of Crazy Rich Asians. Filmed in Singapore, funded predominantly by the Singapore government. But whilst they shot, obviously, a lot of scenes in Malaysian, but they claimed it as Singapore. And that was also because, I'm sure, of the Film in Singapore scheme, and that's provided by the government. So stories like that, that is enabled by the government somewhat with the incentives, does a lot for the country. A lot of tourism arrivals, a lot of tourist receipts. I think, yes. I mean, Henry Golding starring in that is already, and Michelle Yeoh, our ambassadors for us in that movie, But of course, there's related back to the Singapore narrative of crazy rich Asians.
Do you see that enabling either in terms of schemes or in terms of agencies in Malaysia? Are they working well?
There's always complaints because there were funds given out. But of course, people do complain that the funds were not given to the right people, either through corruption or just like lack of efficiency in identifying the right projects. So some of it could be just sour grapes, like, oh, I didn't get it. So you assume there was bribery involved. But some, if it can be proven that they were, there was something dodgy going on, which I think Finas is being investigated now, but only for a few specific cases in the past 2 years, I think. So then obviously that's part of a wider culture, which you see in many other government departments.
I mean, is this an exact science? You know, backing the winners.
I mean, if I can go back to what Amir was saying, I think the Ministry of Communications and Multimedia under the leadership of YB Govind is really seriously looking into that. They're looking into really looking into the issues, because you're right, there have been a lot of complaints. And I think they're looking at right talent. And this is something that the Prime Minister mentioned, that there needs to be right people in leading these institutions. Therefore, they're able to play a role. You know, we need to, you know, Shindana has this philosophy of making sure we always get feedback from the community. And that's why we have our industry advisory panel and our international advisory panel, to make sure that we do what is relevant for the community rather than shock sendiri. And that's why maybe sometimes they go off tangent a bit.
Okay.
A bit.
Hold the thought. There's, in fact, a feedback for this show as well. Let's talk at astro.com.my. You can write to us and tell us what you think about any of these conversations that we're having at the moment. We'll be back with a deeper look at the midterm review of the 11th Malaysia Plan. Stay tuned. Let's talk with me, Sharad Kutan. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan. In the house, we have Amir Mohammed with Kuman Films and Izan Satwina with Chandana. We're going to be referring also to the conversations happening at Parliament today. They had to do with the midterm review of the 11th Malaysia Plan. Now, we're going to have a little clip again from the Prime Minister, Tun Dr. Mahathir, where he talks about their priorities, one of the priorities being regional growth, or, you know, equality and balance regional growth is what he says.
Semua negeri perlu maju bersama. Kerajaan Pakatan Harapan tidak akan membiarkan mana-mana negeri tertinggal di belakang. Oleh itu, kerajaan memperkenalkan kembali agenda pembangunan wilayah yang seimbang sebagai keutamaan. Selaras dengan ini, kerajaan akan memastikan peruntukan pembangunan yang lebih saksama kepada negeri Sabah, Sarawak, Kelantan, Terengganu, Kedah dan Perlis, supaya mencapai pembangunan yang lebih setara.
That was the Prime Minister speaking in Parliament today. Because Parliament is a major gab fest. There's a lot of talk. Not all that talk is as meaningful as it seems on face value. And I think this is something that needs to be interrogated to some extent. We have Lawrence Todd from the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs joining us. Thank you so much, Lawrence, for joining us this evening. I want to begin with the issue of whether a five-year plan actually even makes sense in the 21st century.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, I think that on the one hand, these plans do provide a certain degree of continuity. And I mean, this document itself, I mean, if you've seen it, it's 400 pages of lots of information that's sort of readily eaten up by people like me and you who do follow those things. But at the same time, it's also a bit challenging when you change from one administration to another. What happens to the plan? How much does it change? How much confidence can we put in these long-term plans in a democracy where we do see changes in power, as we have now in Malaysia?
Before we get to perhaps the rather anomalous situation of this current government taking on the plans of a previous administration, one that it's actually vilified in many ways, is the statement we just heard from Tun Dr. Mahathir when he talked about balanced regional growth. Now, I think any analysis of capitalism as a system suggests that there will be uneven development, and that's just the nature of the logic of capitalist growth. And we are largely a capitalist economy with very open borders. Is it even possible for the state to balance out or ameliorate the worst aspects of uneven development?
Well, I think that you're right that there's always going to be a disparity in a capitalist system. I think the question becomes, how does the government ensure that there's enough economic opportunity across the whole economy? And I think the challenge is that these are very top-down strategies to try and create growth often fails to reflect the dynamics on the ground in these different areas. The economic realities on the ground in Sabah are very different than in Selangor. So it's quite difficult to foist the strategy on those regions. And ultimately, what you have to do is instead focus on the role of facilitator, trying to create the maximum scope for economic opportunity.
Lawrence, you know, there has been a debate over the last couple of decades about the nature of East Asian growth, and because Dr. Mathai also mentioned, you know, Malaysia returning, becoming an Asian tiger. The question was whether it was free market driven or whether it was state led. Where is that debate today among economists about, not necessarily just on a normative level, but what is best, whether it's a state or the market, but what is the actuality? What is happening on the ground in terms of economic development?
Well, it's a very big question. I mean, it was hotly debated last week when we had renowned international economists like Joseph Stiglitz and Hadrian Chang in KL to discuss exactly this. And quite often the comparisons get made between Malaysia and countries like South Korea and Taiwan. I mean, I think that one thing is clear, that no economy has been able to really pioneer industrial development without exposure to markets, first internally and then second internationally. So in the very large markets like China, that process of developing internally can go on quite a long time when you've got 2 billion people in your internal market. For a country like Malaysia, and this is also true of South Korea and Taiwan, that their big industrial success stories came through exposure to international markets too. So market is inescapable. I mean, as you said at the beginning, the reality is we are in a capitalist society, and that's true the world over. I think the second crucial thing, and I heard some of your guests talking about earlier in the show, in the context of the creative economy, is human capital. And I think, again, that's where South Korea and Taiwan have been very successful over the last 30 years in developing a very high standard of human capital and retaining it in the country. And I think there's rightly a focus in the midterm review on that issue in Malaysia. And it's a really crucial thing for Malaysia to focus on in the years ahead, is developing that human capital and crucially retaining it so it doesn't leak out overseas to these other markets.
And, you know, Lawrence, what about the other things in the report? I know it's a huge report and it was just released this afternoon, so people are going to be spending their weekends. Perhaps you're going to be spending your weekend reading it. Anything else leap out at you that is important for us to focus on going ahead?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the first thing to say is, as you say, there's a huge amount in there that we'll have to take some time to digest. And there's a huge amount to like. I mean, I think on the political reform, on transparency, on improving public procurement, there's a lot to be welcomed. I think on the economic side, the picture is slightly more mixed. I think there's some clear signaling about trade-offs ahead of the budget, which we've been anticipating for the last couple of weeks now. And there's the clearest signal yet, there's going to be a new tax, specifically on the digital economy. And I think for us, you know, our take with that, that's probably the wrong way to go, that actually there's a lot of space to reduce spending and find these efficiencies rather than introducing new taxes, particularly in the part of the economy that we're trying so desperately to grow. I think the other thing just to watch is this position on whether we're going to see a radical change from this new government in terms of the role of the government in the economy. We've heard some indications over the last few weeks that this new government might look to reduce the level of government investment both in the stock market and also free up some of its assets for whether that's selling land to locals or closing down some agencies. And I think it's interesting that in the review it seems a bit more backward-leaning on that. There isn't really any talk of slowing down the rate of the government's presence in the market. So I think that will be interesting to see how that develops into the budget. I mean, I think it was a huge task for the government to inherit this document with only 4 months to really reshape it. So it's difficult to know quite how much thought to put on it in terms of understanding this new government's long-term strategy. But I think in terms of the trade-off between tax and cutting spending and also reducing the government's assets versus cutting development expenditure, there are some signs of some trade-offs that I think potentially moving in the wrong direction when it comes to the economy.
Yeah, we're going to be having you in the studio later, next week rather, on Monday, and with a full panel and deeper discussion about this. But for the purposes of tonight, I wonder if we could just focus on some of the things that maybe most Malaysians are concerned about, the issues of wages, that their wages aren't moving. And, you know, can government actually do something about that? And are we looking solely at absolute numbers when it comes to wages or their ability, their purchasing power?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, I think the first thing on the purchasing power, I mean, the Prime Minister's made a clear signal that they want to focus, you know, their economic strategy around improving that rather than overall output. And I mean, I think that's totally understandable in the context of, you know, where wages have been and cost of living. I mean, I think that the problem here is exactly as you say, it's a balance between how much can the government deliver this. I mean, ultimately, what you need is to see private sector-led growth delivering the innovation that we need to move up the value chain. And that's indeed, that, you know, I could be quoting from the government by saying that. So I think for the government's role here is to focus on the fundamentals, and crucially that means education and infrastructure. So ensuring the universities have the freedom and flexibility to promote the right skills, ensuring that the right infrastructure is in place to support the digital economy and also more traditional trade. And ultimately that's going to be a longer-term strategy for success rather than trying to focus on winners or intervening in the market to ratchet up wages directly. And I think that also applies to these issues around the cost of living, you know, where there's been particular problems in housing and food. And I think, you know, it's important. I think we need to have a debate now in Malaysia about the role of the market in lowering prices. And in that there is language to that effect in the midterm review, but then, you know, you turn a few pages and it's, okay, we're going to set up a bunch of agencies to drive the affordable housing market. So the two things don't really seem to line up. And I think that's sort of the issue with the new government's economic policy, is they're not really coming down on one side of the fence on these big questions.
Okay, thank you so much, Lawrence, for joining us. That was Lawrence Todd from the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs. Very quickly, are you watching, I mean, are you the kind of people who care about 11th plan midterm review? I mean, is this a conversation, are you sitting around with your friends talking about this?
With friends, maybe not, but certainly with other peers within the network, yes. I mean, I'm also very passionate about policy, so I love to read about all the National Malaysia plans. I want to see where the taxpayers' money also go to. I'm happy to also share, in the past, RMK 8, 9 and 10, there was a lot of mention about arts and culture, from appreciation to preservation to, I think they then set up Micrete Ventures and Malaysia Major Events, and that rolled out incentives and loans to the bigger creative industry players.
So major impact for industry. Okay, we're going to have to take a break now, and then we're going to be coming back with a deeper look at the meaning of the creative industries for the people in the studio and beyond. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutan. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me is Anne Satrina from Chandana, and also Amir Mohammed from Kuman Films. Is that the question of what Chandana does? It survived the demise of the last administration. It seems to be going guns with this administration. They are constantly, you got a very early buy-in into Chandana, if I remember correctly. This is a government of 5 months. And I wonder why. I wonder, what is it that they're thinking? Because, you know, that conversation we had with Lawrence earlier about policy coherence is very important. Where do you think Chandana fits in?
Well, I think Chandana has a slightly different approach. I think we're all about data. We're certainly all about policies. And one of the advantages we have, I think, is our international advisory panel, of which comprises of Australian Council for the Arts, National Arts Council Singapore, BCRAF Indonesia, Thailand Creative Design Centre, and Creative Scotland. And they share with us all their best practices.
I'm a little surprised by that, because I'm thinking, well, is this Singapore rival? Aren't we, in fact, competing with Singapore that wants to be a cultural hub? Thailand, which also, had these dreams, at least under Thaksin. I don't know where it's gone since the military junta took over. And then Indonesia, of course, with a huge population and its own kind of cultural heft. Aren't we competitors?
Well, I guess it, to a certain extent, maybe, but also at a more, neutral level, we're also friends. And I think if we look at National Arts Council Singapore, when they started the council 30 years ago, maybe, they started off with a baseline study that mooted the council, which then mooted their Renaissance Plan City 1, City Plan 2, and 3. And there's so much they have learned in the process, and they've also been quite successful in it. So I think from their learnings with other councils as well, they're open to sharing a lot of practices with us. And there's nothing wrong with that. We learn it, but I think we localize it for our market and what suits our market best.
Now, talking about data, Amir, I wonder, in setting up Kuman Films, were you looking at numbers around about, because this is clearly a business proposition, or is it a labor of love, or is it both? Tell us.
Love is always business.
Love is always business? Oh, yeah, okay. slightly enigmatic, but tell us, what were the numbers you were looking at, what trends were you looking at in order to set up Kuman?
Kuman Pictures, the idea, the name Kuman actually is inspired by Roger
Germs?
Corman.
Oh, it's not Germs.
Both. Okay. Roger Corman, who was a famous American B-movie producer. He's still alive, he's in his 90s. But also Kuman as in Germ, because I wanted a reminder to myself not to make big films. So we only make small films, and the genres are horror and thriller. Yes, because the data says horror is easiest to sell if you're working on a low budget, as opposed to other genres, so people expect. If an action movie, if it's a cheap action movie, people will be skeptical. But if it's a cheap horror movie, at best, you can say, oh, like Paranormal Activity,
So the Hantu Kat Lima, is that what you intend to make?
Not exactly, because that's obviously a big franchise using, very well-known comedians and all that. So, and it benefited a lot from Astro's, various streams of promotion. So we don't mind getting the same numbers in terms of box office, but
plus 36 million.
Our model also, it's a royalty-based system, because for decades, film crew members and cast as well have been complaining that once they get paid for their work on a film, then they won't get any kind of bonus or royalty, even if the film does extraordinarily well. So I sought to fix this by using the model of the book industry, where a certain percentage is always reserved for royalties.
Okay, so you've been creative about the business model as well. Do you think it's essential for business models to innovate in order to attract people, talent into the industry, and keep them there and make it sustainable?
Yeah, obviously, because you can't keep complaining that, no one's buying if you don't know what it is they are willing to buy in the first place. So trends change very quickly. We can't be like the music industry. At one point, they were just denying the fact that, songs were being digitized and downloaded.
Shared.
Yeah, and it took like 10 years for them to come to terms with, oh, let's do something like Spotify. We know that people want to buy, want songs easily without buying individual CDs. So let's find a way to actually make sure revenue does come back to the artist and the producer and so on. But they were in denial for quite a long time, where they were telling people, piracy is theft and downloading is theft and that kind of thing. So I think the movie business adapted much faster with things like Netflix. And now in the West, like YouTube, there's a kind of a premium thing where certain kinds of shows, they don't go to the cinemas. They go straight to YouTube, but you pay to watch. That hasn't started here yet.
Okay, could you tell us very quickly if you have a project in the pipeline and what is it going to be?
The first three horror movies we're doing. The first is in Mandarin. It's called Two Sisters. The second is in Malay. It's called Roh. And the third's in Tamil.
Ro, as in
R-O-H.
Spirit.
Ah, yeah.
Spirit.
Yeah. Ro. Not the fish row. And then the, it's a different horror. It's a vegetarian horror movie. And the third is in Tamil called Irul, Ghost Hotel.
So okay.
I can't remember if it was a coincidence that it had this Muhibah thing, but I'll pretend it was a coincidence.
Okay, are you intending to say, when looking at the numbers, yeah. Tamil films in Malaysia,
yeah, they, don't do so.
They don't do so well.
No, no, no.
But India's a huge market. Can Malaysian filmmakers working in the Tamil language sell to, you know, yes. the 50 million people who live in Tamiland?
As of now, it doesn't seem to be the case, but, you know, anything can happen. And the reason I chose horror and thriller is that, to me, that is the language. I think a Malaysian would be likely to watch a horror film in a language they don't understand. So, like, today, earlier today, I saw a Turkish horror movie. You know,
but you might be an exception. I want to
say, yeah, no, it was shown in GSC. So.
I mean, you know, something that you know, Lawrence also pointed out that you know, countries like Malaysia depend on the world to sell there because we don't have enough of a market. When it comes to culture, does it travel as much as you know, an electronic component?
Mm-hmm. I think Southeast Asia. If we take Southeast Asia, 60 million people.
Mm-hmm. 600 million people.
600 million, close to 7, I think, has a lot of stories, rich in culture. Every other country, Japan, Korea, Australia, is investing so much in relationships with Southeast Asia. And if we look into Cendana, for example, and Malaysia, we have started investing in mobility funds, making travel for our artists to different parts of the world easier. We support their return flights, we support their cargo freight, and when they're invited to festivals, when they're invited or they want to go to a market or a conference, we support them and get them there. Because actually a lot of other festivals, venue presenters are actually interested in Malaysian content. This year alone, for example, this coming November, Five Art Center, Baling, and Nading Rhapsody from Sarawak will be performing in Oz Asia Festival. Last year, Alina Murang performed there as well. So there is interest in the Malaysian content, for sure.
Okay. We'll be back with a deeper look at some other things that are happening in the cultural map right into next year. There's a World Culture Summit that's happening, and that's I think, a very interesting development. So we're going to be asking Izan about that in the next segment. Stay tuned. So Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. Welcome back to Let's Talk. Remember, you can always be part of this conversation by emailing us at letstalk@astro.com.my. Tell us what you think about the issues that we're taking up. We're taking up the issue of the creative industries and creativity as a whole. And, you know, when we left, Izan Satrina, who were at Cendana, and Amin Mohamed, we were talking about, you know, stories that can travel. And I think at the source of much of culture are original stories, story told well. Mm. The question really is, again, are they traveling? Are they not traveling? Why not? What can government do? I want to pick up on something that you were talking about earlier, off camera, as it were, which is that, you
not
know...
Not about Regina Go. Right?
Not about Regina Go, but about the Oscars, and that the Malaysian government does not support or has only twice supported or nominated Malaysian films for that category of Best Foreign Film. And
yeah,
why?
Because it's a fairly simple bureaucratic procedure, which all other countries seem to have no problem with. There's a deadline. Every year, the Film Association or the film board of each country officially submits their film for consideration for this Best Foreign Language category. Maybe you can think it's not a big deal, but there is a list where it comes out, every country submits what.
Right.
And Malaysia has only done it twice. And
is it because of cost?
No, it doesn't cost that much. I mean, it's a sponsor screening there.
So there's a lack of will, indifference? Maybe we don't want to be part of the Oscars?
People are jealous if a film is chosen and theirs is not. So I think it actually boils down to something as petty as that.
Do you think that stops us? I mean, are things like this stopping us from moving forward? Petty jealousies?
Oh, gosh. No, I mean, for example, in Cendana, the CEO doesn't have much say, apparently. All our committees assess all the applications, and the committee members must also sign off a declaration that there's no conflict. If they know that person, they're related, they shouldn't be evaluating it. So that's how we at least manage it. And it's a peer-to-peer assessment, so it's best that the folks from the industry with the expertise to evaluate the applications are the one looking into it.
You know, so this is why I'll never be on that list of evaluators, because I know everybody.
Yes, yes.
This is part of the problem, isn't it? I mean, we do live in a very small society. I mean, the society of creative people are largely KL-based, and they know each other.
Yeah.
I mean, is it become incestuous, or has it become enabling?
I think there's a difference between knowing and being, you know, professionally involved. If you're a partner, if you're an investor, so the simplest thing would be like, if it's a movie, is your name in the closing credits in some capacity, then you're directly involved in the product. It's kind of hard to say, you know, if you're a filmmaker, you don't know at all.
Anybody,
you know, you've never met
anybody. I mean, unless you're like also related by marriage, you know, by bloodline.
Yeah, basic
what
kind of
okay.
things, yeah.
Okay, maybe so we can't really resolve that. I mean,
you can have external
evaluators. We're running out of time, so I just want to very quickly have you tell us a little bit about Banda Activity Seni Kuala Lumpur, which is a project for Cendana, but also this World Culture Summit that's happening, which is intriguing.
Well, I think firstly, the Banda Activity Seni KL was a tactical campaign for us to create awareness for a lot of the shows that were happening. One of the things that we realized in the report that we did, which is also publicly available, is that people were not aware. All the shows that were happening.
Okay.
People were preferring if the shows were strategically located, there's compelling content, and also it's price-wise is more attractive to them in terms of affordability. So hence, one of the things we immediately did was drive the awareness of the campaign via digital media, because that's the top ranked one in terms of their media habits. So that's how we try to drive awareness. The World Culture Summit, for example, that you've mentioned, will take place in March next year. Malaysia, for the first time, is hosting it, thanks to the National Department for Arts and Culture, who had bid for it under the Ministry of Tourism and Culture. And you will be having members from the International Federation of Arts and Culture Agencies. So all the ministries and arts and culture agencies from around the world will be here in KL-PAC.
KL, okay. And that's very interesting, because then KL will get another facelift, because every time we have a global summit of this, we get to say, in fact, we have bicycle lanes. But having walked around the inner part of KL recently, I know that...
It was a drive to make Indian brickfields look more Indian.
Yes, that's that. So there have been some unfortunate impulses that we have of prettifying, you know, the city in a very kind of cosmetic sense. But, okay, we have the budget coming up, Amir. Are you looking forward to the government giving something to filmmakers by way of policy or money in this budget?
Yes, I'm always looking forward.
But
we can't depend entirely or too much on them, because sometimes you have to accept that the money will go to other people, and sometimes they're the wrong people. But so you just soldier on.
You soldier on, he says bravely. Izan, your kind of thoughts on the budget?
Well, of course, we've put in a wish list for the arts and culture.
Oh, you have?
We have. We have put in, not on an allocation basis, but predominantly all on policies. So perhaps considering increasing the corporate tax deduction from 1 million to, I think, 1.4 million.
This would allow corporations to contribute
more to the arts. Two is to consider including an allocation in terms of when you spend money on tickets for the arts, whether it can be bundled up under the lifestyle tax, and therefore you can also enjoy tax exemption.
It's like a gym membership.
Yes, correct. So when you buy handphones, buy
the gym for the
laptops,
soul.
You know, it is part of lifestyle tax. So yes.
Okay, very interesting ideas. I hope the government does, in fact, take up these ideas. Thank you so much for being here this evening. I've been speaking to Izan Satrina from Cendana, and also Amir Mohammed, who's got her new film company called Kuman Films. Yes, you heard it here for the first time. Germs. He's going to be spreading germs. Germinating ideas.
I like that.
Okay, this has been Let's Talk. Remember, we're here every day at 10 p.m. You can send your feedback, your thoughts on letstalk@astro.com.my, and I'll try to respond as much as I can to all your queries and thoughts. Stay tuned. This is Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutub, always on Astro Awani.